speak, of Revelation. And before we begin that, we're going to talk about just some general things here. In terms of the book of Revelation, let me ask you this question. Good morning. How many of you have ever, how many of you have never read through the book of Revelation? I mean, just reading it through. Okay. Okay, now, all of you, with the exception of one person who said they have read through the book of Revelation, how many of you understand what you have read when you've read through the book of Revelation? Ah, that's what I suspected. What is it about the book of Revelation that kind of scares us, you suppose?
Well, it's the uncertainty of much of the imagery.
Okay.
Okay, in Revelation. You know, we even have phrases for it. You know, it sounds biblical or it sounds apocalyptic.
Okay.
You know, it's things that we can't, we understand the image, okay, but we can't relate it to anything in our experience. And
okay.
So we're kind of put off by that.
All right. Okay. What else? What scares you about, you know, just trying to understand Revelation? It's perhaps as a book, it is perhaps looked at as being the least understood book in all of Scripture. Okay, a lot of warnings. Okay. There seems to be this, in a sense, this cloud that hangs over the book of Revelation, that basically a lot of people are of the belief that they can't really understand it, and so they just prefer just to kind of leave it alone. Yeah, I've read it, but I don't understand it, so it's not typically a book that we do a lot of studying in, even. Steve?
Well, not that it's directly related, but I've always seen a pretty good parallel between Revelation and the Song of Solomon.
Okay.
And that book bothers people because it's about two lovers,
right,
in the physical sense. And so we just kind of don't want to see it.
Right.
You know, it makes us uncomfortable. So.
Oh, absolutely. And that's a good point. And when you look at this kind of writing, though the topic is extremely different, the methodology of the writing is very same because it's mostly symbolism. And that's where we get kind of tripped up oftentimes, is that if we don't understand, first of all, the fact that it's symbolism, then, you know, we're gonna get off right from the beginning, you see. And one of the things that we, you know, as you talk to different people, you know, maybe at work or wherever, you know, in your, you know, daily routines or whatever, and people talk about the end times, there are a lot of words that are thrown out there. There's a lot of concepts and ideas that people use that really indicate a lack of understanding of what, you know, the book of Revelation really is all about. And so there's this mystery that is there that makes us tend to want to kind of stay away from the book of Revelation, when really what we should do is focus some time on it. We did a class on it here not long ago. We need to do it some more, you know. But what I want to do, and the purpose of this, keep in mind, is this whole study we've been doing is a survey of Bible history. We're highlighting things, that we're not going into all of the intricate details and all the stories and so on and so forth. We're basically highlighting, and so that's what we want to do with this. What I want to do with folks is to, first of all, try to take a lot of the fear away from the book of Revelation that people have of not being able to understand it. In other words, I think a lot of folks just have this idea, I can't understand what it's talking about, so why bother, why waste my time reading it if I can't understand it? I'm hoping that we can take away, some of that concept when we're talking about in the survey kind of a thing here, that just to reinforce to people, yes, there are, you can understand it. It's not as easy to understand as some other things, but if you understand the code, then you can understand what it's saying, okay? And that's one of the things that you have to keep in mind. There is a code book, okay, or there's a code for this kind of writing. When we're talking about prophecy, you're talking about apocalyptic literature, then you have to understand the code, so to speak. And the more you understand the code, the more you can understand what is being said. And the reason I say code is because one of the first things you have to keep in mind about reading the book of Revelation is you cannot take every statement in there literally. And that's one of the biggest problems that people run into, is they're trying to read it and take it literally, the numbers and the symbols and all of those things. And when you try to do that, it gets really confusing. Okay, so that's one of the first rules to keep in mind. It is not intended to be literal. The word apocalypse is basically a revelation or an uncovering or disclosure. That's what the word basically means or indicates. Apocalyptic writing is a type of book or writing in which the theme is developed by the use of symbols, okay, or visions. So if you stop for a minute and just kind of wrap your mind around that whole idea, it's basically saying what I said a moment ago. You cannot take every statement in there literally. It's not intended to be literal. Okay? The use of the symbols and the visions is there to try to give some kind of a picture that we can relate to or what have you, to help us to better understand something that might otherwise be completely and totally beyond our comprehension. For instance, in the book of Revelation, when it's talking about the New Jerusalem and it gives this description of the New Jerusalem towards the end of the book here, what kinds of symbolism or visions do we get concerning what the New Jerusalem is going to look like? Streets of gold. That's one of the most prominent, right? Streets of gold, gates of pearls, a sea of glass. What are all of those things? And why use those kinds of visions? Okay. Yeah. They're physical representations of the spiritual reality. All right? And that's what you have to keep in mind. There's no way in our human physical mental capacity that we could really comprehend and understand what heaven is really like. And so God has given us these visuals in terms that we can relate to try to help us to comprehend not necessarily simply what it's going to be like in terms of what it's going to look like, but the magnificence of it. If you could imagine, and the whole intention then is for you to kind of get lost in the idea of thinking, this place is going to be so wonderful that the streets are going to be paved with gold. Could you imagine living in a place where the streets were literally made of gold? You see? I mean, there's some ritzy neighborhoods around, right? Okay? But none that I know of where the streets are literally made of gold. And so the idea is not to say that the streets in heaven are literally going to be made of gold, but it's to give us the idea and the concept that it's going to be so magnificent, it's really, you can't really imagine beyond that how wonderful it's going to be. See, that's really the intention and the idea. If I can give you a visualization of what this is going to be like, you see, in terms that I can relate to and you can relate to, then, okay, all right. that's something that's desirable, as opposed to what are the descriptions that it gives of hell? A lake of fire. You see? You know, we all know what a fire pit is, right? You know, and who wants to fall into one of those? How about a volcano? You've seen pictures, you know, on TV of volcanoes and that, all that hot lava coming out. Who would want to fall into one of those? You see, it's those kinds of comparisons, visuals and imagery that are used to help us to get just an idea of how wonderful and great or how terrible and devastating the reality is. So keep that in mind as you're studying Revelation, and that'll help you to not get caught up in, you know, the trying to make this literal in terms of what it's actually saying there. You know, again, keep in mind when we're looking at Revelation, you're looking at apocalyptic writing, not just Revelation, but any apocalyptic writing. Keep in mind the intended use of symbols and visions to explain things. There are some specific characteristics about apocalyptic writing that would be helpful if you were familiar with. And one of those is that usually apocalyptic writing has been done in times of crisis. Okay? In other words, at the time that those things were originally written, there's a time of crisis that is at hand or is imminent. Okay? As in the case of the book of Revelation, what was happening? Yeah, the persecution of the church it was on fire. It was really hot for people in the church in terms of the persecution. There was a lot of problems in that. And so definitely it's a time of crisis. Now, another aspect of it is that we find is that it has a dualistic character. In other words, there's two sides, so to speak, of the coin. All right. For example, in its outlook, apocalyptic writing is both pessimistic and optimistic. Okay. So in other words, and one of the things that that I use to describe the book of Revelation in particular, you kind of look at a summary in a nutshell. How do you describe what the book of Revelation is really saying? Well, first of all, it's saying things are bad. Okay? Secondly, it says things are going to get worse. Okay? And then finally, the other side of the coin is what it says is, but God is in control. You see, and everything is going to turn out okay. So you have that dualistic characteristic. So, you know, it starts out as, you know, things are bad, but ultimately things are going to work out okay. And that is a characteristic of that. It's pessimistic, but then it is also optimistic. The other characteristic in this dualistic aspect is the different forces that are at work there. You've got evil on one side and you've got good on the other side. It's the, you know, the Star Wars, the Darth Vader, you know, and the Force is with you and all of those, you know, you've got one side is dark and the other side is good, and that's a characteristic of apocalyptic literature, and we find that just throughout the book of Revelation in the story that it tells, the vision that it gives. It paints a picture that things are bad, but it's going to get better. Why? Because God is in control. And then throughout, you've got the two forces that are at battle or at odds with one another. You've got God and the forces of good on one side, and you've got Satan and the forces of evil on the other side, and they're doing battle. You see? And that's why it's bad, okay, to begin with. But it's also why it's good in the end, because God is ultimately going to overcome Satan, you see? So you have that particular characteristic in there, okay? Any thoughts or questions as we're going through that?
Well, one thing that's always struck me about Revelation, and what you just described, the battle, it makes it very clear that the battle is above and beyond us.
Right.
You know, the earth is kind of like the passive victim, you know, and the people on it. You know, these things are going to happen, you know, because these higher forces are at work.
Well, and that's true. And if you stop and think about it this way, when you look at the whole picture of what's going on, and I've talked about this in various classes and things that we've had, and we're going to see this a lot more in our next study that we're talking about here, that ultimately, what is the great battle that is taking place over? It's over us. It's certainly not over any physical territory because it's a spiritual battle. It's not like the battles that our history records for us where, you know, people are fighting over land and territory. You see, no such. It's over the ultimate prize, and that is us, the creation of Almighty God. You see, we are the objects of desire on the part of both sides, you know, on God and of Satan. God wants us, and his desire is for us to be saved, to be with him. Satan's desire is certainly just simply to destroy us, because that's the only way that he knows that he can hurt the Creator. The more of the creation that he can destroy, the more hurt he brings upon the Creator. And that's what the battle is all about. And so in that sense, we really are the ones that you know, that battle is taking place, you know, in the spiritual realms, and we're the ones that the battle is over. You see? In that sense, we are the battlefield. We've talked about spiritual warfare over and over again, and every single one of us is involved in that spiritual warfare. Okay? Because of the nature of the spiritual aspect of it. It's not a territorial war in terms of physical. Okay? And that's one of the things we have to keep in mind as you look at Revelation. Again, we're looking at symbolism. We're looking at visions. We're looking at things that show pictures to us of what the reality really is. Think about it this way. The Ark of the Covenant and the tabernacle in the wilderness, and then ultimately the temple in Jerusalem. Okay, all of those things were built, and let's talk about the tabernacle in the wilderness. When God was giving instruction to Moses to build the tabernacle in the wilderness, what was one of the most significant things that God repeated to Moses over and over and over again? What? Follow the pattern? See to it you do it exactly according to the pattern I showed you on the mountain. Why was that so significant? Not just obedience. The writer of Hebrews would tell us that tabernacle in the wilderness was only a shadow of the reality. You see? In other words, it was God's way of giving his people something physical that they could relate to, see, that would give them a concept and an idea of what the reality in heaven was all about. You see. And that's one reason why the whole the Holy of Holies was designated the way that it was, you see, that it was restricted to who could go in there and when and how often and so forth. It wasn't just where anybody could just walk in and go, "Hey, God, how you doing today?" It was very, very restricted. Why? Because what does that represent?
God is.
The throne room of God. Now, we come to the New Testament times and Christianity. And what's the difference now that we have that they didn't have that God wants us to understand? We talked about this Wednesday in the men's Bible study we were talking about. We have access where, again, the writer of Hebrews tells us we can approach the throne of grace with confidence. You see? Which was something they couldn't do. But now we can. You see? So it's just that whole idea that God gave his people a visual to help them to somehow try to understand what the reality really is. Okay? And that's what Revelation is doing. Okay? It's giving us some visuals here to try to help us to understand at least as much as our human capacity will allow us to understand what the reality is. Okay? There are a lot of different sources of apocalyptic writing. There's several in the Bible. Old Testament examples, for instance, the book of Ezekiel, specific parts of that, Isaiah, Joel, Zechariah, Daniel, have apocalyptic writings in them. Okay, Matthew chapter 24 in the New Testament, Mark 13, Luke 21, 1 Thessalonians 4. All of these are a type of apocalyptic literature, okay, that are giving visions of what is to come. All right? Let's talk about one of the things that is so important in being able to understand this writing is the use of numbers. Okay, now we've talked about that, you know, when we're reading Revelation, we have to understand it as symbolism, and the numbers, certainly, we have to understand them in that very same way. The numbers in Revelation are not intended to be literal. Okay? So, for instance, when in Revelation 7, I believe it is, where John talks about the 144,000 that are going to be saved. Okay? He looks and he sees this 144,000. How does he describe those 144,000? Somebody turn there. How does he describe them? There was 12,000 from every tribe. Okay? Does that mean literally there are only 144,000 or only 12,000 from each of the tribes of Israel that are actually going to be in heaven?
What are we doing here?
What? No, this is just of Israel now. This is just of Israel. Okay? Well, yeah, but let's just focus on this part of it, the 144,000, because if you read after he talks about and he goes through and talks about each tribe and how many, you know, there is from each tribe, 12,000 from each tribe, then he says, after that I looked and saw a great multitude from every nation under heaven that no one could count. Who's that? That's us. Okay? All right? But let's go back to the 144,000. Okay? Is not intended to be to focus on a literal 144,000 Jews is all that's going to actually be in heaven, and only 12,000 from each tribe. It's kind of like there's a contest, and you know they all know, say, hey, you know, I want one of those 12,000 seats for my tribe, you know, and so forth. No, the number represents a completeness. You see? So it's not intended to be a literal 12,000 or 144,000, which is multiples of 12, but it is rather a complete number. So literally what it really means is the complete number of the Israelites that are going to be saved are going to be saved. Does that make sense? Do you understand it, you see? So that's how numbers are used in this kind of writing. All right, let me give you some examples of how different numbers and what they mean. And hopefully by going over some of these, it will help you as you're reading Revelation to be able to understand a whole lot more of those things. First of all, the number one, okay? And you have to understand that you know, in the early history of mankind and so forth, You know, before literacy was, you know, a big thing and so forth, numbers and symbols were a major way to communicate. Okay? So thus they were used a lot to represent ideas or concepts. All right? So keep that in mind and understand, for instance, that man saw a single object and came to associate that with the number one, the idea of unity or independent existence. Okay? So one object by itself represents unity or singleness of existence. It stood for that which was unique and alone. Okay? When man went out to hunt the wild animals or fight against a foe, he found strength and courage in companionship. Two were far stronger and much more efficient than one. Thus, the number two came to stand for strength, for confirmation. Okay? In the book of Revelation, the truth is confirmed by two witnesses who are slain and rise again. There are two beasts that represent a formidable foe. Okay? Because man found love in the home, father, mother, and child, the number three came to be the number for perfection. Okay? And thus it came to carry the thought of the divine. Right? As we find the whole concept of the Scriptures of the Trinity. Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit. Okay, way back when, man looked upon the world as being flat. Thank you. Okay? You know, in early history, that's how men thought it was. Men looked at the world as being flat. Thus, the world had what? It had four corners. And we sometimes still use phrases like the four corners of the earth. You see? Because of that kind of a concept. All right? So then, it had a flat surface with four boundaries. Okay? There are four winds. Okay? There is, you know, you look on a compass. How many points, how many directions do you have, Major? There are four, right? North, south, east, and west that we primarily use. Of course, there's all the other degrees, but primarily that's what we tend to focus on, right? People tended to live in a house that was surrounded by four walls. See, their world was made up of fours. Okay? So four then becomes the cosmic number, or a number that represents the world. Okay? In Revelation, four living creatures, there are four horsemen. The world in which men lived and worked and died was conveniently symbolized by the number four. Okay, next, man turned to study himself. And this writer here says, perhaps our decimal system arose from the intense study by a man of his own fingers and toes. Okay? A perfect man was one who had all of his members intact. Okay? I mean, think about it. You know, when your little babies were first born, what's one of the first things you want to do? Count the fingers and toes. Make sure they had them all, right? Okay? Did they have everything? Why? Because that was normal. See? That's what it's supposed to be. A perfect man was one who had all of those intact. So the number five, doubled to ten, came to stand for human completeness. Right? Human completeness. In Revelation, there are 10 horns, also 70 and 1,000, those numbers are used. You have to look at it in terms of not just the number itself, but multiples of that number. Like I said a few moments ago, you look at 12, okay, and multiples of 12. Thus, 12,000 from every nation of Israel, and 144 total. You see? Again, not literal, but those multiples representing that complete number. Okay. Ultimately, when you're starting to multiply those numbers, they represent ultimate completeness, or completeness raised to the nth degree. Okay. Man took the perfect world, number 4, and added it to the perfect divine number 3, and obtained 7, the most sacred number to the Hebrews. Okay? When each group is perfect, okay? All right, you bring those together, you have complete perfection. 4 times 3 is 12. This was a test. I just thought I'd test you to see, you know, and y'all are kind of like, I'm not sure. I think it's 12. Last time I checked, it was. Okay. In Hebrew religious thought, it was the symbol of organized religion in the world. Okay? Again, thus the references to the Israelite people as being represented by 12 and multiples of 12. Okay? 7 cut in half becomes 3.5. Okay? Which came to express the incomplete. Right? That which was imperfect. It symbolized restless longing not yet fulfilled, aspirations unrealized. Always 3.5 or its equivalent stood for the indefinite, the incomplete, the dissatisfied. But it all was the hope and patient waiting for a better day when truth would be delivered from the scaffold and placed on the throne, usurped by wrong. So there's that. It's not fully there. It hasn't quite gotten there. It's not complete. It's lacking. But there's hope there that somehow we'd be able to finish. Somehow we'd be able to reach that completeness and so forth. Okay? And then there's one last number that we need to keep in mind, especially as it comes to the book of Revelation. What number did we leave out? 6. Okay. To the Hebrews, 6 had sinister symbolism. 6 was the charge that met defeat with success just in its grasp. It had the ability to be great, but failed to measure up. What does that sound like? Satan. When you go through and you understand the what took place, and we talked about the war in heaven and Satan's position. Satan, from all accounts I can understand, Satan was, of course, like all the other angels, was a created being by God, but he was not just any angel, he was an archangel. Okay? Of the order of Michael and Gabriel. Okay, so he was a head angel, had a lot of angels underneath him. Okay, but what happened? He tried to take God's place and lost. You see, he was, as it indicates here, he had success in his grasp, but wasn't able to acquire it. Right? He failed. And so thus, when we read in the book of Revelation, the number that is symbolical of Satan is what? 666. See? And that repetitive nature of it is not just 1-6. See? But it's repeats 666 to indicate what? Well, not only does it never stop, but it ultimately it was a complete failure. He's never going to be able to attain what he sought to obtain. Okay. Any thoughts or questions on that at all? Well, seven we talked about. Seven being the number that represents the perfect world and the perfect divine. Putting those together, that's the most sacred number to the Hebrews. Okay, and I don't know of any. I don't have any information or anything of any specific symbolism for the numbers 8 or 9. I just don't know what those are. There may be some in there, but I don't know of anything. I've not ever run across anything.
As reluctant as we are to get into Revelation, I think all of us, for some reason or other, shy away from it. There is a promise of a blessing in there to read it,
absolutely,
to understand it, and of course to obey it.
Absolutely.
But there's also a curse in there. If you add to or subtract anything out of Revelation, there's a damnation in there.
Yes, indeed. And so, you know, we've got to be careful, you know, in terms of how we, you know, how we treat it and regard it. It is not to be trifled with. But again, it's not something that we should be afraid of. You know, my intention here is to try to remove some of that mystery for you, to encourage you to jump in there and start reading and studying it. Look up some things and you'll be amazed at what you will find. Okay?
The problem with that is that those who have really tried to study it to give the benefit of the blessing have thought to themselves if they fully understand it and want to interpret it to everybody else.
Right. Well, and that's where the adding to and taking away from and so forth. And you hear people, you know, talking about, you know, the rapture and, you know, all these kinds of things and the, you know, probably one of the most popular teachings, false teachings, I should say, is the whole issue of the thousand-year reign. You know, that you know, when Christ comes back again, as the Bible teaches, he's going to set up his kingdom here on earth and reign for 1,000 years. And that's, you know, that's not what the Bible teaches, but yet that is one of the false teachings that people just keep pushing and pushing and pushing, you know, from a misunderstanding of the book of Revelation and what it teaches. And so there is an awful lot that is added to and taken away from it simply because people don't understand the true nature of the writing. Okay, Steve?
In terms of restoration history, I know Alexander Campbell is referred to as being a post-millennialist. That was his, I guess, belief, which you don't hear much about that anymore.
Right.
Is this you know, angst that we have over Revelation, based on what you know, is that something that has kind of always been there? From the restoration, you know, forward.
Well, you know, even before was, then.
Even before that.
Yeah, even before then.
It's never really dealt with.
Right.
During the.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, it's been, you know, the book of Revelation has been shrouded in mystery, probably, you know, almost since it first was given by John. You know, because I think people didn't really. You know, they're looking at it in the wrong way, in the sense we've talked about. Well, you know, literally, well, I don't understand, what does this mean? And so there's been all kinds of things. If you stop and think about it for just a moment, you know, and there's all this talk and, you know, in the political realm and everything, especially what's going on in the Middle East right now, and we hear these different comments and everything, who is one of or our greatest ally in the Middle East? Israel. Why is that? Why are we so aligned to Israel and you know, so, you know, staunchly defending Israel? Yeah, that's part of it, but that's a very minute part of it. A lot of our political positions on Israel and the Middle East have to do with the War of Armageddon. See? And the concepts that are misunderstood from the book of Revelation that basically says, you know, hey, ultimately, you know, there's going to be this great war, and it's going to be between good and evil, and that's what the Bible talks about, this war of Armageddon, and we want to make sure we're on the right side. So we're supporting the Israelites. Okay? I mean, there's a whole lot more to it, but in a nutshell, that's a major part of what forms and shapes our foreign policy when it comes to the Middle East. You see, is those kinds of beliefs. Keep in mind, those policies have not been shaped and formed in the last 10 years. They were shaped and formed decades and decades ago. You see, when these kinds of teachings were very prominent. Okay? Very prominent in the world. See?
Yeah, just part of that is when Israel declared its independence, which I guess was 48.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was kind of a political battle
that was
going on in this country. Between the people that, like you said, the Battle of Armageddon, we want to be on the right side. There was also a group of thought that said Israel lost their promise and they should never be allowed to exist. And that went on
right
in the 40s in this country and in the political circles as to which way we were going to jump.
Exactly.
You know, and the one that won out was, you know, the, okay, we've got
And much of it, if you go back and you look at a lot of the political stuff that was going on in that time and the writings and so forth from that particular time frame, then again, a lot of it has to do with support because, again, the Battle of Armageddon is coming sometime and we want to make sure we're supporting the right side so we don't lose that war. So we can see how this book, in a lot of its misunderstanding and confusion, has affected the world in a lot of different ways. So it behooves us as God's people to take the time to search and study it, you see, to grasp it in a much, much better way. All right? Okay, we're out of time. You know, I could spend weeks and weeks and weeks and even months talking about Revelation, but that's all we have. That is the conclusion of our survey of the Bible as we've been